I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's March 8th, and we have a lot to talk about. And I want to start off by thanking those of you who turned out yesterday and participated in the National MS Society's Public Policy Conference. I think we may have set a record for the total number of attendees. But I hope you'll consider the conference as your first step in engaging as an MS activist. And you can be sure that we'll be talking about advocacy-related issues as they arise throughout the year. One of the things that we talk about often on this podcast is depression and MS. Another subject that comes up a lot is the way that MS affects cognitive processes. And the reason that we tend to talk about these two topics so frequently is because these are two very common MS symptoms. If you're living with MS, there's a good chance that at some point you're going to deal with depression and cognitive dysfunction. And if you're interested in really understanding how these symptoms can impact someone's everyday life, then I think you're going to really appreciate my guest today. Joining me to talk about his new book, Mind, Mood, and Memory, The Neurobehavioral Consequences of Multiple Sclerosis, is author and expert, Dr. Anthony Feinstein. Dr. Feinstein has spent the past 26 years researching behavioral disorders in people living with MS. He also maintains a clinical practice in which over 80% of the patients are people living with MS. And as I said, if you're interested in the specifics of how depression, cognitive dysfunction, and memory issues can make everyday life at home or at work more challenging for someone living with MS, I think you'll appreciate my conversation with Dr. Feinstein, and I know you'll benefit from checking out his new book. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Anthony Feinstein, there are a few other things that you should know about. Between February 24th and 27th, the America's Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis held its annual meeting in West Palm Beach, Florida. This marked the first in-person MS research conference to take place in the United States in just about 2 years. In last week's episode of Real Talk MS, you heard my conversation with Dr. Amit Bar-Or, this year's winner of the Barancic Prize for Innovation in MS Research. This week, I want to share some of the research that was presented at the conference. Conducting clinical trials for relapsing-remitting MS is challenging. And conducting clinical trials for primary progressive MS? Well, that's even more challenging. In primary progressive MS, disability accumulates slowly and gradually over time. So if you're a scientist contemplating a clinical trial to determine whether a new drug produces a meaningful effect for people living with primary progressive MS, you either need a very large trial or a very long trial. And either of these options becomes logistically difficult. Now, Dr. Jean-Pierre Fallet, a graduate student at McGill University in Canada, presented an alternative strategy that could be an answer to this logistical challenge. Dr. Fallet's approach uses a type of artificial intelligence called deep learning to predict how a potential clinical trial participant will respond to a specific treatment for primary progressive MS. Selecting participants who are most likely going to respond to a given treatment in a study increases the trial's ability to determine whether the drug being studied actually delivers a meaningful benefit. This technique is called predictive enrichment. This deep learning process presents a computer with a very large amount of data. And by processing that data against an algorithm or a set of mathematical rules, the computer learns by detecting patterns in the data that are too complex for a human to see. Then the computer applies those patterns to a new set of data. Dr. Fallet's team demonstrated this new approach to facilitate predictive enrichment by applying his technique to the results of clinical trials for Ocrevus and rituximab. And in this demonstration, the computer was able to successfully identify which patients should have responded to these new treatments, and in analyzing the actual results of these clinical trials, well, the computer demonstrated far greater efficiency in making the correct prediction. Dr. Fallette's research team calculated that a hypothetical year-long clinical trial that only included the top 50% of predicted responders would need just 500 participants to be able to identify a drug's meaningful effect on disability progression. Compare that with a trial that recruits patients using the standard methodology that's in use today, and the same study would require 3,000 participants to detect a significant effect. Clinical trials take too long, and they're too expensive. Using deep learning to facilitate predictive enrichment may be one way to fix both problems. However, Dr. Fallette's team did offer one limitation to this approach. The computer won't tell them how its algorithm is using the data they supply to make its highly accurate predictions. I know a lot of you are interested in stem cell therapy, and the results of a small study of 71 people with aggressive MS who had undergone autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, were presented by Dr. Francis Brunette of the University of Ottawa in Canada. The study participants included 60 people with aggressive relapsing remitting MS and 11 people with aggressive secondary progressive MS. After their stem cell transplant, the follow-up period for each of these study participants ranged anywhere from 8 months to 20 years, and all 71 participants experienced no new MS relapses while being followed in this study. Before their stem cell transplant, the average annual relapse rate for each study participant was just about 1.5 relapses a year. The average age of the study participants was 32.5 years, and the average time between being diagnosed with MS and receiving their stem cell transplant was about 5.5 years. 41% of the study participants were women, and 59% were men. None of the study participants experienced worsening disability while being followed in the study, and some of them experienced mild improvement in disability. Now, those study participants who showed this mild improvement were among the participants with less disability to begin with. MRI data was available for only 33 of the study participants, but all 33 showed no new lesion activity following their stem cell transplant. So although this is a small study, it certainly shows encouraging outcomes for autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation as a treatment for aggressive MS. Dr. Bruce Bebo, the Executive Vice President of Research at the National MS Society and a frequent guest on this podcast, presented a really interesting study measuring the economic burden of MS. The study was designed to calculate the economic burden of MS in the United States in 2019, including direct and indirect medical costs and lost productivity, and also predict the future economic burden of MS for 20 years through the year 2039. To calculate all of this, the research team looked at the prevalence of MS in the United States. They looked at direct medical costs that were reflected in data from insurance claims. They calculated future earnings loss due to premature death by looking at CDC mortality rates and Medicare claims data. And they calculated non-medical costs by surveying almost 1,000 people affected by MS. The researchers calculated that in 2019, the total economic burden of MS in the United States was $85.4 billion. I feel like I should almost pause for a moment and let you really absorb that number. That estimate includes $63.3 billion in direct medical costs, $21 billion in indirect costs, and $1.1 billion in non-medical costs. Now, of the $63.3 billion spent on direct medical costs, $33.9 billion, or 64% of the total direct medical expense, was spent on disease-modifying therapies. Of the $21 billion in indirect non-medical costs, earnings not realized due to premature death were calculated at just over $8 billion. Economic loss due to presenteeism, or being at your job but not being able to be 100% productive due to MS, well, that was estimated to be $5.9 billion. And economic loss due to absenteeism was estimated to be $5.5 billion. The research team estimated the prevalence of MS in the year 2039 is going to reach 1.1 million people in the U.S., and the economic burden of MS is estimated to grow to $105 billion by 2039. Right now, we're spending almost $40 billion a year on disease-modifying therapies in the United States. So if you needed a single-sentence argument for explaining why access to affordable medications is so vitally important, well, I think you now have it. The other number that jumps out from this study is the $8 billion in lost income, or income never realized due to premature death. If you needed a single-sentence argument that explains the impact of living with MS, well, I think this one is as good as any. Now, if you'd like to review the abstract for this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. The economic burden of MS is something everyone living with MS is all too familiar with on a very personal level. The psychological burden of MS, the neurobehavioral consequences of MS, may be a bit more invisible, but are every bit as profound and potentially debilitating. Joining me in a moment to talk about how mind, mood, and memory can impact people living with MS is author and expert, Dr. Anthony Feinstein. My guest today is Dr. Anthony Feinstein. Dr. Feinstein is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, and he's an expert in the neuropsychiatry of multiple sclerosis. In fact, Dr. Feinstein has spent the past 26 years researching behavioral disorders in people living with MS. He also maintains a busy clinical practice in which over 80% of the patients are people living with MS. And he's written a fascinating new book titled Mind, Mood, and Memory: The Neurobehavioral Consequences of Multiple Sclerosis. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Feinstein.
Thank you very much, John.
In your book, you write that a person's mental state is made up of three individual components: cognition, mood, and behavior. And you go on to illustrate with what I will say is profound clarity how MS can impact one, two, or even all three of these fundamental pillars. One of the first topics that you tackle in your book is cognitive impairment among people with MS. I talk about cognitive dysfunction often, and in previous episodes of the podcast, I've reported the results from clinical trials that show that MS can impact information processing speed. But that's a pretty abstract idea. One of the things I really appreciate about your book is how you've created these composite case studies that so clearly illustrate the real-world consequences of what that means. We get to see exactly how a decline in information processing speed can affect someone at their job, how that situation might even be life-changing for them, and even how that one cognitive symptom can actually bring on other symptoms like depression and anxiety.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I think you summarized it very well. And this is what I see, you know, day in and day out in my clinical practice. So the first observation is someone could walk into my room, pre-pandemic, of course, they could walk into my room and you would have no idea that this person has multiple sclerosis. And yet that person is struggling at work. And why is that? So we begin the investigations. We do assessments. We get a neuropsychological assessment, and we explore their cognition. What we find is that, you know, there's a 40% chance that this person's going to have a problem with processing speed. Well, what does that do? That slows down your ability to think quickly. That has a knock-on effect in terms of multitasking. It might affect your working memory ability as well. And if this is a person whose occupation is one that is very much intellect-based, they're relying on their smarts basically to get their job done, if you've got a fall-off in your processing speed with these knock-on cognitive consequences, it can have a profound effect on your ability to work. And I see that time and time again. So a single neuropsychological deficit can have vast ramifications for a person.
Your discussion of memory loss in MS is fascinating. And the example case histories that you share couldn't be more different. On the one hand, we learn about a high-flying, massively successful investment advisor, but we also learn about a stay-at-home mom, each living with MS, and each sees how something called episodic memory loss turns their lives upside down. Can you talk about what episodic memory loss is and how it might impact someone's day-to-day activities?
Yeah, so that's your memory for, you know, the events that have taken place in your life, your day-to-day activities, as it were. So if you've got difficulties with your episodic memory, and I say, well, you know, what did you do yesterday? Just tell me what you did at work. And a person can have great difficulty remembering the kinds of activities that they pursued. And so, you know, transplant that into different clinical situations. You've got the man who is an investment banker who's got to remember what his clients are asking him to do. They're telling him to place trades. They're telling him to do this and that. And he's dealing with vast sums of money. You can understand that if he forgets one or two of those instructions, he's going to have clients who are not going to be particularly happy with him. But then, you know, have a look at everyday activities. The woman who is at home with her children and she's having to run the family, she may have to work as well. You know, there are so many things that you've got to do to keep a family running efficiently with young children. She goes to the supermarket, she forgets to buy certain things. She comes home, she's not even aware that she's forgotten to buy them. Children don't have toothpaste, there may be no soap, etc. You know, and this happens time and time again. You can see how memory deficits like that can start derailing a person's life and affecting the way a family functions. And that's where you see memory problems having such a significant impact on people's functioning, whether it's high-end occupations or the routine activities of day-to-day living.
And as if this episodic memory loss isn't enough of a challenge, can you explain what meta-memory is and how it can further complicate that scenario?
Right. So meta-memory refers to a person's ability to accurately appraise their own memory. How good are you at judging your own memory? And there's evidence that people with multiple sclerosis, like many other acquired brain illnesses, are not very good at that. And so if you are not accurately assessing your own memory, you are not aware of the deficits in your memory. You may underplay the problem. You may think there's nothing wrong. Or, you know, sometimes you kind of overinterpret and you think too many things are wrong. So it's very, you know, it can be very disabling not to be aware of your own cognitive abilities, because if you're not aware of it, you don't correct things. You don't put things into place to try and counteract the fallout from your deficits. You just keep on going, making the same kind of mistakes. And so meta-memory is a very key variable in disability, people's ability to accurately appreciate the accuracy of their own memory.
In examining cognition, you write about potential changes in information processing, memory, and executive function, or the brain's ability to make decisions and solve problems by being able to plan and sequence elements of the problem, while also providing the ability to think in the abstract. Now, first, you tackle each of these cognitive impairments as single symptoms. Later in the book, you point out that people living with MS frequently have multiple cognitive deficits and as a result face even greater challenges in day-to-day functioning. And once again, your ability to provide real-world illustrations of how being globally impaired impacts an individual and their family, I just found those illustrations striking. In one of these case studies, you feature a family. And the wife is living with rather advanced progressive MS. And when you talk about her husband, Bob, well, honestly, you could have been talking about me several years ago when my wife was living with advanced progressive MS. I found that of all her symptoms and disabilities, it was that global cognitive decline that impacted me the most, because that's when it felt like I was watching this person I knew better than anyone else in the world begin to disappear right before my eyes.
Yeah, well, my first off, I'm sorry to hear of that. I mean, I certainly know of the challenges you've had with MS in your family. And you're right. That's a very painful and difficult thing for family members. And many times family members don't understand the change. They don't understand where it's coming from. They can falsely assume that, you know, a loved one is not putting enough effort into something. They're just not trying hard enough, or they're deliberately being difficult, or they, you know, they're being cantankerous. They don't understand that this is not under voluntary control often, that what's happening is that cognition is being lost. And as you develop global cognitive impairment, your behavior starts changing. It's not just a matter of your memory that's failing or your executive function is becoming more impaired, but it's also your drive and your motivation and your ability to respond with empathy. And you know, your social skills start decaying as well. So you start getting this global deterioration in a person's behavior, your cognition, the mood, the behavior, everything starts changing. And then, you know, the dynamics within a family profoundly shift as a result. When you've got someone who, you know, for 20 years has been functioning one way, high functioning, working, you know, running the family, maintaining social relationships, doing all those things, and then suddenly starts being lost piecemeal, bit by bit, and it all starts changing progressively, the effect on the family is profound, on spouses, on children, grandchildren, on friends. And so it's critical that family members have an understanding of where these changes are coming from. I found that in my clinical practice, when you can explain the origins of these changes to family members, it becomes much easier for someone to accept it. Still very hard to live with it, of course, but it becomes easier to accept it because you understand that this is coming from brain changes. This is not a person deliberately trying to be difficult or being obstinate or not showing that kind of drive and motivation that they once had. And the neural mechanisms, the neural explanations for all of this.
A moment ago, I heard you mention mood, and I certainly didn't want to overlook that. Depression is something that we talk about on this podcast because, well, as you point out in your book, evidence shows that 50%, that's one in every two people living with MS, will develop major depression at some point. Your book points out that different patients require different kinds of interventions. Antidepressants may be the answer for some, cognitive behavioral therapy may be the answer, and even mindfulness meditation can provide benefits. You also point out that these treatments may be effective, but won't necessarily be effective for everyone.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the first important point is this. The diagnosis of depression is often missed in a busy neurological practice. And that's very unfortunate because depression is something that is potentially treatable. And depression is the major determinant of quality of life. You know, if you're depressed, you don't have a good quality of life. And depression also adds to the magnitude of cognitive challenges. Depression is also linked, and needs to be said, to suicidal ideation and completed suicide. People who are depressed also have a worse neurological outcome. So here we see mood affecting a person's neurological outcome. And recent data also shows that people with MS who are depressed overutilize healthcare services. So you can see from multiple reasons why depression is so important in terms of a person's MS. But the biggest one, of course, is that if you miss the diagnosis, you're not going to treat the person. And while there are still, you know, many unanswered questions as to what the best treatment is, we do know that some people can respond very well to antidepressant medication or very well to cognitive behavior therapy. Or occasionally you put together a package of interventions, medication plus CBT, medication plus mindfulness therapy. You know, when you get a person whose depression lifts, it's transformative. It's transformative to their lives.
When people talk about depression, they might describe it as feeling a certain way. But your lab has been able to use imaging to identify strong relationships between those feelings of depression and actual structural changes in the brain among MS patients. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I think that was really an interesting and I think very important clinical finding. So my group built on some earlier data showing that people with MS who become depressed, clinically significantly depressed, a major depression, are more likely to have lesions in certain parts of the brain that we call the limbic brain, parts of the temporal lobe and the medial frontal lobe. So they have a heavier lesion volume in those areas. We also showed that even if you look at normal appearing brain tissue, so this is brains that to the naked eye appears normal, we can extract subtle abnormalities using MRI from those brains, and once again show that in depressed people, they are more likely to have these subtle brain changes in the exact same limbic areas, the medial frontal, anterior temporal parts of the brain. When you look at functional MRI, so we're not looking at structure now, we're looking at networks, the way the networks activate, the functional MRI data matches the structural data. In other words, researchers have shown dysfunctional connections between parts of the limbic brain, for example, between the hippocampus and the amygdala on the one hand and the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex on the other. So we see a nice marrying of the functional and the structural brain imaging data that helps us understand why some people can develop a profound depression. The reason why that, I think, is so clinically significant is this. I have a patient who can come to see me with MS who's actually doing well physically, you know, having no difficulty walking. Their social life is okay, they're happily married, their kids are fine, there are no financial worries, but that person has become profoundly depressed. And the patient says to me, why? Why am I depressed? You know, I know I've got MS, but my MS is well controlled by my disease-modifying drug, my life is generally fine, but I'm still depressed. The MRI gives us clues as to why that person might be depressed, because depression is a brain disease, and of course MS is a brain disease. And so it may well be that depression, for some people, is a direct symptom of their multiple sclerosis, a direct consequence of the brain changes.
The final chapter of your book sort of closes the loop by expanding on some of the same questions, issues, and even the same metaphors that you raise in chapter one. And once again, by using a composite case study to illustrate the point, I think you so effectively demonstrate what is possible when it comes to clinically addressing the challenges of mind, mood, and memory that MS presents. Almost 150 years ago, French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot was the first to identify the cognitive dysfunction associated with MS. Your book brings that conversation about mind, mood, and memory into the 21st century and plots a course that I know you and many other researchers will continue to travel. The name of the book is Mind, Mood, and Memory, The Neurobehavioral Consequences of Multiple Sclerosis, and you'll find it at Amazon.com. Dr. Anthony Feinstein, thanks so much for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks again for talking with me today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John, and thank you for having me on your podcast. I enjoy talking to you. Thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/236. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's an easy way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.